I'm so envious of musicians because I am as far away from being one as I possibly could be. So, all right. So, can you guys hear me okay? All right. So we're starting a new series today, leading up to Easter, and it's called The Road to Jerusalem, and there's this idea that the road that leads to wherever is limitless, is boundless. I remember growing up as a kid and listening to folk tales where I'm from in the Appalachian Mountains called Jack Tales, and they always centered around this kid named Jack who left home to go on these grand adventures in these strange and exotic places like Tennessee and Virginia. And it was this sense that he left everything behind, who he was before and what he was before, and kind of reinvented himself and became this grand hero on the road. And that kind of idea is really prominent in our minds in America, is this idea that we can hit the road, we can go anywhere, we can have these grand adventures, and we can leave who we were in our close-knit, tight communities behind, reforge an identity for ourselves and become something different. And there's this sense of freedom and this sense of individuality and this sense of release in the idea of the road. Now, the road we're going to be traveling along this Easter, leading up to this Easter, is, of course, Jesus' road. And Jesus travels a road to Jerusalem and his death. And that's what we're going to be looking at this next couple weeks as we look at the Gospel of Luke. And if we took all the times when Luke tells us that Jesus turned towards Jerusalem, or he turned in the direction that he knew he was going to be heading, or he turned in the direction of where he knew he was going, we would be in this series for months. But we've just taken a couple of texts that Luke tells us where Jesus knows where he's going, he knows what he's going to do as he heads to Jerusalem. And that's what we're going to be exploring these next couple of weeks on the road to Jerusalem. If you'll pray with me. Lord, I pray that you open our hearts and our minds to your teaching. Not mine or man's, but yours. Guide us as we explore what it means to be disciples of you who follow you each and every day of our lives. There's wonder, there's joy, there's pain and there's sorrow, but there is most of all you. Be with us this morning. In your name I pray. Amen. On April 30th, 1789, standing in Federal Hall in New York City, George Washington took the oath of office and became the first president of the United States of America. The decisions he made and the things he did while in office set the tone and the shape of the American presidency that has endured to modern times. On September 17th, 1849, in an area called Poplar Neck in Caroline County, Maryland, Harriet Tubman made her first escape from slavery. Eventually, by using the Underground Railroad, she made her way to Pennsylvania and freedom, marking the first of many trips she would take over the years as she led hundreds and hundreds of slaves to freedom in the North. On November 19th, 1863, standing at Soldiers National Cemetery in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, Abraham Lincoln delivered a short 271-word speech known as the Gettysburg Address. This speech would become known as one of the greatest speeches in U.S. history. On November 14th, 1872, while standing in her home in Albany, New York, Susan B. Anthony was arrested by the U.S. Marshals for voting in the 1872 presidential elections. Her subsequent trial pushed the woman suffrage movement into the forefront, the national conscience. I could name hundreds more. Rosalind Franklin, Alexander Graham Bell, Craig Breedlove, his wife Lee Breedlove, Gertrude Ederle, John Glenn, Krista McAuliffe, names after names after names of people who have made an impact in history. by the things they've done. People who through their lives and actions did something or many things that changed the world. Have you ever thought about changing the world? Have you ever thought that you could change the world? Most of us lose the youthful optimism, that belief that we will or we can change the world, or that our lives carry historical world-changing significance by the time we reach our 30s. Most studies say the late 20s, early 30s, we lose our optimism because life has hit us day after day, time after time, then we begin to lose our optimism, and we become pessimists. We lose our idealism, and we become pessimists and cynicists. We fall into the daily grind of work, eat, sleep, repeat. Work, eat, sleep, come to church, as Pastor Joe said at the very beginning. And we fall in this kind of this humdrum of life. We lose the vision for the possibility of a life that can change the world. We begin to live for the weekend, where we can experience short bursts of pleasure and relaxation before jumping back into the daily grind. We go from dreaming about being a world changer to dreaming about being a Netflix binger. We're caught up in the daily grind, and so we live to escape. But we're meant for more. Our lives carry so much more meaning, so much more potential than we can even fathom. And this potential is found in the words of Jesus' questions. Who do you say I am? You can make an argument, as some do, that everything in the 24 chapters of Luke, which is what we read from today, revolve around this question. And you can make the argument, as I hope to do today, that all of life, all of it revolves around that question. If you hear nothing else from me today, hear this. This is the most important question you can ask and answer yourself in your life. Because its implications affect everything. Everything. Who do you say Jesus is? That answer means everything. Now Jesus asks his disciples first, who do the crowds say I am? Who do just the people around you say that I am? And the disciples answer that the crowds thinks he's various people. Some say John the Baptist, some say Elijah, and some others say, you know, some other prophets of old. And all of those are pretty spectacular in their own ways, mostly because for Jesus to be any of them, he would have had to have been a dead person resurrected. And in some cases, like John the Baptist, the two people at once. If Jesus is Elijah or John the Baptist or one of the prophets from the past, then it is amazing. It is certainly enough to make a difference in the lives of some of the people that are around him for a little while. I mean, people can't deny that. That's why they're asking the question. They've seen the things that Jesus is doing. He's healed those who are blind, people who are crippled or lepers, or those who are sick, he's made well. He's taught some really good things. Things that make people stand up and take notice. He spoke truth to power. He's come down to the level of the people. He's working from the grassroots. He's rolled up his sleeves and he's dug in with the people. He's eating with them. He's rubbing elbows with them. He's mixing with them. He's doing some really important things. But to many in the grand scheme of things, he's no different than other amazing people in the history of Israel. He's just an interesting blip on the radar of history. But really no different than any of the others who've come before him. He'll live like the prophets and like Elijah did and like John the Baptist did. He will die like them. And history will march on, making note of his accomplishments, perhaps even remembering him for a little while, even celebrating him. And when he comes near a town, people will come to hear him speak because he speaks of some amazing things, or they'll be healed because he does some amazing things. But except for the few that have some lifelong lasting effects, he'll just really be a pleasant distraction for a while. If he is only a prophet or Elijah. Now, if your answer to that question is like the crowds, if Jesus is just some great historical figure, someone like a Washington or a Lincoln or an Anthony or a Tubman, if Jesus is a great moral teacher along the lines of someone like Gandhi, or then he's most certainly noteworthy and perhaps inspiring even. He's worthy of study, but really nothing more. And today, most people wouldn't argue that Jesus never existed. They would say, yeah, he existed. He was just this wise teacher or this good man, this great historical figure, this great leader even. You might even think that today. You may be here today and think that. But if Jesus is only just this great historical figure, he has no impact on your life beyond somebody like a Washington, Jefferson, a Lincoln, an Anthony. Maybe he goes on a coin or a dollar bill. But that's it. But if Jesus is more, if Jesus is something more than that, then it changes everything. Jesus asks the disciples, who do you say that I am? Peter doesn't say one of the prophets or Elijah. Peter says, you are God's Messiah. God's Messiah isn't just anyone. It isn't some just rando walking down the street. God's Messiah, Messiah is Hebrew for anointed. The Greek word Christ means anointed as well. That's where we get Jesus Christ. God's Messiah, God's anointed, is someone that is sent by God, specifically chosen to rule with the full authority of God as king. Wrapped up in the idea of God's Messiah is the Jewish idea that there will come a king to Israel, chosen by God, who will make things better. This king, this anointed one, will change life for the betterment of his people forever. He will bring prosperity. He will care for the pain and suffering of his people. He will care about the injustices carried out on his people. And he will move to make them right. But the implications for who Jesus is are much, much deeper than just earthly kingship. So, so much deeper. As we'll see now. Hundreds of years earlier, the Israelites had actually been taken away in captivity to Babylon, where they spent many years. We have many accounts of their time there, of the time they spent in Babylon. And one of the accounts is from a person held in captivity who was made a servant or slave of the Babylonian Empire, of the king. And his name was Daniel. And he did some pretty cool things. If you've been around church any length of time, you know who Daniel is. Even if you haven't been around church, you've probably heard of Daniel in the lion's den. It's that Daniel. And so we have this book in the Old Testament of Daniel that talks about this time spent in Babylonian captivity. And the story of Daniel is basically this: a young man removed far from home remains faithful to God. He's a man who follows God in the face of suffering and deprivation. And in Daniel chapter 7, Daniel has this vision. Now, Daniel's a really cool book if you ever want to read it. The first half is like awesome. Like if you're a kid, it's like top five of young boys' list of cool Bible books. But then you get kind of through the halfway mark of Daniel and things get really weird because Daniel starts having these visions. And in Daniel chapter 7, Daniel has this vision. And in this vision is this promise that God gives to his people who are in captivity in Babylon, who are suffering. And it's the first year of the reign of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. And Daniel has this vision. He's in bed. It's not at night, and he's in bed getting ready, I guess, to go to sleep, or maybe he's already asleep. But he has this vision. And in this vision, there's this great sea. And the sea is just, I mean, the waves are crashing. It is chaos. And out of this chaos, out of this just crazy ocean, comes these four beasts. And Daniel tells us a little bit about these beasts. The first beast is a lion, one like a lion, he says, and it comes up out of the water. And the second beast is one like a bear, and it comes up out of the water. And the third beast is one like a leopard that comes up out of the water. And then the fourth beast is like, he doesn't give us a description of what it looks like, other than to tell us that it's terrifying, as if the other ones aren't, and frightening. And there's a lot going on with this creature. There's iron teeth, and it crushes and it devours its victims. It's got these horns, and so we have this scene with these creatures coming out of these depths of the sea in this chaos, and it's just evil. And then in the same vision, we get this other scene. The scene of power, a throne room where God is seated on his throne with thousands upon thousands attending him, and just sheer power comes from this image. His clothing is as white as snow. His beard and his hair is as white. It's overwhelming. And his throne is a flaming fire, and this river of fire flows from his throne. And the courts stand, and the book of judgment stands open. And Daniel tells us that the most terrifying, the most powerful of the four beasts is killed, is slain. And the other three beasts are kept alive, but their power is removed completely. And then Daniel tells us this. Daniel chapter 7, verse 13 and following. He says, I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient of Days, that's God, and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. Chinese theologian Chun Liong Xiao, professor of Hebrew Bible at Vanderbilt, says that the point of this entire vision, I'm going to boil it down for you, is that the forces of evil on earth may appear to have dominion on earth, but the fate of the world is determined in another realm by God, who is wholly transcendent and yet ready to intervene in human history. And Jesus points his disciples towards this picture of what it means to be God's disciple or God's Messiah when he refers to himself as Son of Man. It isn't a kingship like David or any king that they've ever known or had. It isn't a kingship like Caesar or Alexander the Great or Pharaoh or any of the Babylonian kings, anyone that they've ever known. Instead, it's a picture of kingship like the one that Daniel saw. One like the Son of Man who comes with power such as no one else could ever have. This is a picture of a cosmic king with eternal, all-encompassing power in the form of man. Now I imagine that this is what his disciples wanted. This picture of power. This picture, this unstoppable picture that would destroy all that's evil. This is what I imagine they wanted. And I kind of sense or imagine them standing there and their hearts kind of leaping. And them thinking, yeah. But Jesus gives them a dose of reality of what it really looks like for Jesus to be God's Messiah. Because he doesn't explain how he's going to kick butt and take names. Instead, he says that he must suffer at the hands of those in power. He's going to be hurt. He's going to suffer. And he must be killed. There's no way around it. Jesus must be killed. Now, there's something operating here out of our sight. Something that we don't see unless we really look closely. It's the word must. That's not a weak word. It's not that Jesus might have to die or he's going to think about dying or he'll be obedient to whatever God wants and it might be death. He must be killed. It's what he's here on earth to do. And it shapes the rest of our passage this morning. Now, the explanation I'm going to give you is not original to me. I've heard it many times by many different people, so I can't take credit for it, but it's really good. And it's helped me as I've reflected on why Jesus must suffer and die. And this version of it I've taken from Tim Keller. And he says this. He says, what if a friend of yours accidentally smashes a lamp in your apartment? One of two things can happen as a result. Either you can make him pay, that'll be $100, please. Or you can say, I forgive you. That's okay. But in the latter case, where you forgive him, what happens to that $100? You have to pay it yourself. Or you have to lose $100 worth of light and get used to a darker room. Either your friend pays the cost for what he has done, or you absorb the cost. Now, this works at levels beyond economic, too. When someone robs you of an opportunity, robs you of happiness, of reputation, or takes away something else that you'll never get back, that creates a sense of debt, a sense of debt. Justice has been violated. This person owes you. Once you sense that debt, again, there are only two things you can do. One thing you can do is try to make that person pay. You can try to destroy their opportunities or ruin their reputation. You can hope they suffer, or you can actually see to it that they suffer. But there's a big problem with that. As you're making them pay off the debt, as you're making them suffer because of what they did to you, you become like them. You're becoming harder, colder. You're becoming like the perpetrator. Evil wins. What else can you do? The alternative is to forgive. But there's nothing easy about real forgiveness. When you want to harbor vengeful thoughts, when you want so much to carry out vengeful actions, but you refuse them in an effort to forgive, it hurts. When you refrain, when you forgive, it's agony. Why? Because instead of making the other person suffer, you absorb the cost yourself. So it isn't surprising that God's Messiah says that the only way that he can forgive the sins of the human race, is if he absorbs the cost. Either we pay the cost, or he absorbs it. Only he can do it. Right behind me on that sign from Romans. The Son of Man must suffer. He absorbs the cost, the wages that we have to pay. That's God's Messiah. And all of this matters because if we follow him, then the pattern we are to follow, the thing that shapes our lives, will be that Messiah. I'm not a musician, so I asked Phil Pike for some help this week. And I asked him, what do you do when you first sit down to play a piece of music? When you first walk into a room and you're given music, what do you do? And he says there are a few things that he looks at. He says he scans the entire piece of music looking for key signatures, C major, F minor, etc. I don't even know what that is. Time signatures, 4-4, 3-4, 6-8, 7-8. You musicians know exactly what I'm talking about. Repeats and codas, tempo markings, style indication, scans up for all these things because that guides how they will play the music. It's what makes it possible for them to go in and play one, something that sounds good, but also together. It shapes and forms how they do it. Without it, there'd be just a bunch of racket and noise. But with it, man, it could be something beautiful. Something that lasts. A masterpiece. And Jesus is like that. He is the one that we look to pattern our life after. He is the one we look to guide us as we navigate the complexities of life in this world. He tells us this very thing. He says, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross daily and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will save it. I always hear that passage, and I always hear it kind of taught as like, oh, you got to pick up your cross and go out and do this thing. And there is that element. But he promises so much more. It's a beautiful thing in the end. You see, we're short-lived creatures on this planet, if you think about it. In the grand scheme of things in the cosmic timeline, we're like this little bitty bump. But we get caught up in that bump, that moment, because of our perspective. We think that the here and now is all there is, and we can get caught up in the sheer physical reality of our life. In these, if we're lucky, 80 to 90 years that we're here. We get trapped in the moment. Have you ever been on vacation or known somebody on vacation that you're like, you're in this place and it's awesome and you forget everything else around you? And just for that 1 week you're on vacation, and even though you budgeted for your vacation, you way overspend. Because you're not thinking about the bills at home or the car payments and the house payments. You're just thinking about vacation. It's nice. And you're going to live it up. And then the vacation ends and you go back home and you're like, oh crap, there's more to life than just the week of vacation I just took. And you spend the rest of the year digging yourself out of the hole. It's because you get trapped in that moment. It's true of us here in our lives. We get trapped in the moment. We think all that there is here. This wood, this paper. We don't pick up our cross. We don't want to. Instead, we want to set it to the side while we do our own things, while we pursue our pleasures and the things that we want. We chase after the things that we think give life its meaning. Whatever that is for you. But Jesus reminds us that when we pursue what we think gives us life, we miss something. We miss that we only truly gain life when we lay it down to follow him. And that when we pursue the appetites of life without thoughts of what is beyond, we actually lose our life. Played out in Jesus' rejection of the one who is ashamed of him. We're given a choice. Come to him, find true, eternal purpose for our life, or reject him and lose eternal purpose and be rejected. In the face of sacrifice, pain and suffering that we sometimes face as Christians. I mean, when I talk about forgiveness, that's a real thing. If you forgive somebody, you eat that. If you give up something that you want to go do for something better, you eat that. If you give money to God's work in this world, you are eating however much you give that could have been spent on something else for yourself. If you choose to live out a life of sexual purity, you're giving up all this other stuff that you could have had for purity. You eat those things. And in the face of that kind of sacrifice, sometimes pain, sometimes suffering, we can lose sight of the eternal and we can let go of it. We can lose sight of the transcendent. We can let go of it. And in a life where so much is physical, we can easily turn to that. We miss the little part of what Jesus says when he says that he must suffer, he must be killed, and on the third day be raised to life. We forget that we too share in the power, the resurrection power, the eternal power. PJ says the best is yet to come. A life lived in the service of King Jesus, a life lived following him, gives ultimate meaning to our lives here. And our lives in service to Jesus here has eternal meaning, no matter how small, seemingly small, it might seem. Whereas the most world-changing, most effective leader of our world today may mean very little in the grand scheme of things. In Luke 15, Jesus tells these parables, one about lost sheep and the other about a lost coin. And he explains in both of these accounts what he means about the parables. In Luke 15:7, he says, "I tell you that in the same way there will be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who do not need to repent." We're told that there is more celebrating in heaven over one person who is brought to Christ. He doesn't say, there's more celebrating in heaven when you make your first million. There's more celebrating in heaven when you rack up numerous possessions or lead a Fortune 500 company or become president of the United States. He doesn't say that. The impact is in heaven. There's a short story called Leaf by Niggle by J.R.R. Tolkien. Leaf by Niggle, you can find it online. It's free. It's pretty good. And he wrote this. He wrote this short story in frustration of a longer work that he was working on. This literature that he was working on. He was frustrated by it. He wasn't making a headway. He felt stuck. Like what he was doing didn't mean anything. J.R.R. Tolkien wrote Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, you know, those little known books and movies now. But he didn't feel significant. He didn't feel like he had any purpose in life. And so he wrote this story to kind of work through that. And in this story, the main character named Niggle is an artist. And he's working on this magnificent work of art, this tree, that will represent the most beautiful tree in the world. And it's going to be a stunning work of art. And it will change the world. But as he works on this tree, he keeps getting interrupted to help his neighbor do things. And each time he gets to work on his tree, he is interrupted. And then he goes back to his tree, and he gets interrupted again, and he goes and helps his neighbor. And until one day, he's helping his neighbor, and he gets this cold and dies from it. And as he's traveling into heaven, though this is a fiction story, so as he travels into heaven, and it's an allegory, so as he's traveling into heaven, as he gets closer and closer, he sees this beautiful tree in the far distance. And as he gets closer and closer, he realizes that it's his tree. The tree he's worked on all his life that he never finished. That the work he had done on earth had greater significance beyond just the life that he lived. And he never fully realized it till after death. All of us. All of us have the opportunity to live lives of significance beyond this world, beyond this life. The call from Jesus is to follow him. Give our lives to him. Lay down our lives before him, and you gain something far greater than you could ever grasp for yourself. Eternal significance. Pray with me. Lord, help us to grasp this truth. Help us to answer the question, who are you? And then shape our lives based on that question. Help us to answer the question. Help us to believe, to see you, to see you in all your power and glory, and to know that you are who you say you are. Help us to give our hearts to you, our lives to you. If there are some here that don't know the answer to that question today, Lord, I pray that you just make a clear path, a clear picture of that for them today. They might lay their lives down for you. Come to you. Those of us who know you, who believe who you are, Lord, that sometimes get caught up in just the world, help us to turn back to you. Help us to shape our lives around you. Help us to look to you as a beautiful piece of music and not just some drudgery we have to carry on day in and day out. Lord, I pray for all of us here today, that you will help us in that, when we answer that question, to live out lives of eternal significance, because that's what you've made us for. To your name be the glory, the power forever and ever. Amen.